now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console, the award-winning Jeff Wolf. And the reason I say that is he was awarded the WMAL Employee of the Year Award for this year. So we want to congratulate Jeff on that. Jane Houghton, who is a fixture at WMAL for decades, is our producer this morning. And it is great to have you with us. Overnight, there's been shelling again from the Russians as they launch into the second year of the Ukraine war. The European Union announcing new sanctions. The U.S. committing $2 billion in military aid, $10 billion in new humanitarian aid. President Zelensky addressed reporters yesterday in Ukraine.
We started to free our land from Russian evil. We are in return of security to international relations. And you and I can make this year 2023 to be the year of the end of Russian aggression, the year of the return to peace, the year of the liberation of our land and our people from Russian captivity.
And I mentioned $2 billion in new military aid committed by the United States. President Zelensky is asking for F-16s, but here's how President Biden explained his decision on F-16s to David Muir on ABC World News Tonight last night.
You don't think he needs F-16s now?
No, he doesn't need F-16s now.
Is that a never?
Look, first of all, the idea that we know exactly what's going to be needed a year, two, three now, but there is no basis upon which there is a rationale, according to our military now, to provide F-16s.
But you're not ruling it out.
I am ruling it out for now.
And you know that President Biden was in Europe this week, a surprise visit to Ukraine, and he spoke to NATO about our commitment to NATO on Wednesday.
To NATO, I've said it to you many times, I'll say it again, is absolutely clear. Article 5 is a sacred commitment the United States has made. We will defend literally every inch of NATO, every inch of NATO.
And that was earlier in the week, and as I mentioned, the president spent some time with David Muir on ABC's World News Tonight last night. He was asked about the Chinese spy balloon by David Muir.
Let me ask about U.S.-China relations in general, already strained after the Chinese spy balloon over the U.S. Let me just ask you this first. Do we know definitively yet whether or not that spy balloon was flying over the continental U.S. intentionally?
It is almost not relevant once it was over the United States.
So there's a possibility President Xi didn't know?
There is a possibility of that.
So that is President Biden saying there's a possibility that President Xi didn't know about the balloon. Many pundits have already disputed that, and I'm sure they will continue to dispute that take on President Xi. And we had one more from David Muir and President Biden last night, and the big question that has been asked so much of the president recently, will he be running again?
My intention is hasn't been from the beginning to run, but there's too many other things I have to finish in the near term before I start a campaign.
Is your age part of your own calculation into whether to run again?
No, but it's illegitimate for people to raise issues about my age. It's totally legitimate to do that. And the only thing I can say is watch me.
The First Lady might have shed a little more light on that subject. She's traveling in Kenya. And she gave one of the clearest indications yet that he is going to run. She told the Associated Press in an exclusive interview yesterday that, quote, there's pretty much nothing left to do but figure out the time and the place for the announcement. He's not been quite as crystal clear as Joe Biden has. She also said, quote, how many times does he have to say it for you to believe it? The words of Joe Biden yesterday in Nairobi, Kenya. Well, there was an announcement last night from James Comer, and of course he is the new head of the House Oversight Committee, and he is announcing an investigation into Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg's handling of the train disaster in East Palestine, Ohio. And James Comer making that announcement last night for the House Oversight Committee, and he appeared on the Fox News Channel last night.
We want to know the response from the Secretary of Transportation. The people in this community in Ohio are concerned. No one from the federal government seemed to express an interest in their well-being. No one at high levels of the government. And we want to know what communication took place, who made what decision based on burning the chemicals. How do we know who's coordinating with the EPA and other emergency agencies that will ensure that groundwater is not contaminated? We just have a lot of questions, and this administration has been too busy to provide answers for the American people. The president is out in Ukraine promising more tax dollars to Ukraine to protect their border when our border is insecure, and the Secretary of Transportation has had personal time. He hasn't had time to go out there. So we want to know exactly who's in charge and what decisions were made and when they were made.
Well, that's not the only thing that is of concern to James Comer about Mayor Pete, our transportation secretary. The House Oversight Committee chairman went on.
Well, you know, that just shows the arrogance and the tone deafness of this administration. We have a lot of concerns with what's going on in the transportation cabinet. We have airline delays. We're having rail disasters. We have an infrastructure crisis. The federal government just invested a significant amount of money in infrastructure, and all we've heard from the Secretary of Transportation is that infrastructure's racist and that there are too many white people that are going to be working in these construction jobs. I mean, this isn't the type of leadership that I think the American people expect from the Secretary of Transportation. So we have a lot of questions for Mayor Pete, and hopefully he's going to cave to public pressure and start providing us with answers. This is the Oversight Committee. We're not going to let up just because the Democrat turned a blind eye to providing any type of oversight of the Biden administration for the first 2 years. That's over now. The Republicans are in the majority. We have questions that the American people deserve answers for.
Well, as I'm sure you have heard, former President Trump was in East Palestine, Ohio earlier in the week. The day after former President Trump was there, the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, showed up, and he has been asked a lot this week about his response to the rail disaster, and this is Mayor Pete speaking yesterday.
What I tried to do was balance two things, my desire to be involved and engaged and on the ground, which is how I am generally wired to act, and my desire to follow the norm of transportation secretaries. I'll do some thinking about whether I got that balance right.
Yeah, he's got some thinking to do. He's wired to be on the ground, and he stayed on the ground in D.C. for, what, 2.5, 3 weeks now. Well, former President Trump was there, obviously raising eyebrows from virtually every other media outlet aside from 3 or 4 conservative outlets. Everybody found fault with the former president's visit there. We've got a couple of sound bites of former President Trump in East Palestine, Ohio, earlier in the week.
Biden and FEMA said they would not send federal aid to East Palestine under any circumstance. They're not going to send aid. I thought that was a strange statement. When I announced that I was coming, they changed their tune. It was an amazing phenomena to the people of East Palestine and to the nearby communities in Ohio and Pennsylvania. We have told you loud and clear, you are not forgotten. You are not forgotten. We stand with you, we pray for you, and we will stay with you in your fight to help answer and the accountability that you deserve.
And in the comments that the president made, he was somewhat toned down. It was not a campaign rally. He was pretty much in that same tone of voice the entire time.
I sincerely hope that when your representatives and all of the politicians get here, including Biden, they get back from touring Ukraine, that he's got some money left over what this community needs now are not excuses and all of the other things you've been hearing, but answers and results.
And that is the former president who brought with him thousands of bottles of water, which he had collected, I think, from a number of the different Trump properties around the country. He was criticized for that, and he was also criticized for buying lunch for some of the first responders at McDonald's. He was criticized for that. He did say at McDonald's that he knew more about their menu than the employees did, which I thought was kind of a funny line, but he was, as you know, he spends a lot of his money with McDonald's, but a lot of the media people didn't seem to find that to be too funny, and there are even stories about the brand impact on McDonald's for the former president having been there and purchased hamburgers for first responders. It's 6:20. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. And Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Beltway, both in Maryland and in Virginia, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop. Back in Maryland, if you're traveling between the two beltways, either on the BW Parkway or 95, lanes are clear between Baltimore and D.C. And on 50 in Prince George's County, you're not tapping the brakes eastbound or westbound between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge. At the Bay Bridge, you got two lanes headed east and three lanes coming west. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Cold start to your weekend with a little bit of light rain and snow possible mid-morning to early afternoon. A coating in the grass, not out of the question, but no real big issues for the roadways. The only concern, higher elevations out west. Highs today only in the upper 30s. Tonight, cold, maybe some patchy fog in spots. Tomorrow, back into some sunshine, mid and upper 50s to near 60. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff.
Thirty-one degrees in the nation's capital. 6:21, the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler, and after our very balmy, 76-degree high on Thursday, we're at 31 degrees this morning. Yikes. Continuing on, presidential race. We were just talking about President Biden, and sounds like he's going to be running again from all the indications. Republican race, though, a little different. Not sure where that one's going to end up. Of course, it would appear that former President Trump is ratcheting up his campaign already. Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador and South Carolina governor, has announced that she is in the race. Now, instead of the mainstream media acknowledging that she is the first woman of color who would be running as a Republican for the presidency of the United States, she was attacked by the mainstream and liberal media. And this is just a sample of it from The View. Here's Whoopi Goldberg.
A new generation. You're 51. What are you talking about? But it's not a new generation. She may be younger than most of those people, but her rhetoric is the same. She's saying the same BS.
To quote Zora Neale Hurston, not all skin folk are kinfolk. Nikki Haley instead is the Dinesh D'Souza of Candace Owens. She's the alpha Karen with brown skin. And for white supremacists and racists, she's the perfect Manchurian candidate.
Wow. You really said that, dude. Okay. Well, how did Nikki Haley respond to all of that?
I have had this all my life. When I was first elected governor, there were some minority Democrats that said, she's not a minority, she's just a conservative with a tan. They will come at me with everything, but none of that fazes me. If my age is all they have, it means we're winning.
So that is Nikki Haley, who is in the race, and also another person of color who has been attacked for being a Republican is the South Carolina Senator, Tim Scott. And there's a lot of speculation as to whether he will run for the 2024 Republican nomination. Well, he was in Iowa this week and on kind of a fact-finding mission, but we know when a senator goes to Iowa, that's an indicator that they're considering getting into the race. And here's how Tim Scott spoke about his differences with President Trump. He was asked by Sean Hannity, what are your differences with President Trump?
Probably not very many at all. I am so thankful that we have President Trump in office. Frankly, the policies that we were able to pass from 2017 to 2020 were monumental. And thank God we went into COVID with a strong economy. We brought the unemployment rates for African-Americans, Hispanics, for women, Asians, all to all-time lows or the lowest since World War II. We passed Opportunity Zones, my signature legislation that brought more than $29 billion back to the poorest communities just in 2019, leading to the lowest level of poverty ever recorded as a country. I think the policies that we fight for as conservatives are the policies necessary to stop the Democrats from ruining America.
So that is Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, sounding like he could be running for president there. There was some controversy back and forth, social media stuff going on this week. When President Biden was in Kiev, he walked outside with President Zelensky, and air raid sirens were going off. A lot of conservative social media types were saying, well, it was staged, and of course, the other side from other sources on the more progressive liberal side were saying, no, there was a jet over Belarus, so that triggered the sirens. So we thought we'd leave it to Alex Marquardt at CNN to give his assessment, and then you can make your own judgment from this.
I've been here for the past 5 days. I have not heard any explosions. I have not heard any air sirens until about half an hour ago, right when President Biden was in the center of Kyiv, as Clarissa was just mentioning.
And we're at 6:26 on the Saturday morning update. Bernie Sanders was on Face the Nation. This is so good that I'm going to make you wait to hear it. We're going to take a quick break, and then you got to hear about Bernie Sanders and his book tour. That's next. Stay with us on the Saturday Morning Update. Saturday Morning Update continues. So Senator Bernie Sanders has a new book out. It's okay to be angry about capitalism. Let me repeat that. It's okay to be angry about capitalism. So he's on a book tour, and the tickets range as high as $95 in some of the markets. If you wanted to see him in D.C., he'll be at the Anthem. That's a kind of a large new facility, which is down on the waterfront. The $35 tickets are gone. So if you want to go, you're spending somewhere between $75 and $95. It includes a book, so we'll mention that to be fair to the senator. But it kind of stood out not only to me, but it stood out to Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation. And here's when she asked Senator Sanders about the ticket prices.
Tickets for your tour apparently are selling for $95 on Ticketmaster, which is accused of anti-competitive behavior. Some of your Democrats are criticizing them. Aren't you benefiting yourself
from this system that you're trying to dismantle? First of all, those decisions are made totally by the publisher and the bookseller, but I don't make a nickel out of these things at all.
But you're okay doing business with Ticketmaster?
No, not particularly, but that's, again, I have nothing to do with it.
I have nothing to do with it. Wait a minute. You're the guy that's speaking. It's your book they're selling. What do you mean you have nothing to do with it? You got to love it. I mean, here's the guy railing on Ticketmaster in the hearings. You know, Democrats all over Ticketmaster in the hearings recently, and Bernie's railing on capitalism all the time, including the book, the title, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And who is our number one capitalist of this segment of the show? It is Bernie Sanders. Unbelievable hypocrisy. And the idea that he would say he doesn't know anything about it, and he went on to say, well, you know, this is between the publisher, it's between the venues and Ticketmaster, and I have nothing to do with it. You signed a contract. You didn't know it was in the contract? You had nothing to do with this? How do you not know? It's just, you can't make this stuff up. 6:31 now on the Saturday Morning Update. It is the Saturday Morning Update, and in the news at this hour, a powerful winter storm is lashing California, threatens floods, blizzards, and avalanches today, adds frigid temperatures to a misery mix, they're calling it. National Weather Service says overnight lows could drop below freezing in some areas, while downtown San Francisco could see record-breaking cold this morning. Weather Service issuing flash flood warnings for areas of Ventura and Los Angeles counties. 6 million people reside in those counties. First Lady Joe Biden says there's, quote, pretty much nothing left to do but choose the time and place for President Joe Biden's reelection announcement, making that announcement in Kenya. The First Lady is traveling 5 days in Africa this week. Ukraine's leader is pledging to push for victory in 2023 as he and other Ukrainians mark the somber anniversary of the Russian invasion that upended their lives and Europe's security. President Volodymyr Zelensky saying that February 24th of 2022 was Ukraine's longest day, but the country's resistance a year on has proven that, quote, every tomorrow is worth fighting for. 6:33, it is the Saturday morning update. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Maryland side of the Beltway, Outer Loop and Chevy Chase disabled vehicle. The shoulder is blocked right near Connecticut Avenue. On the inner loop of the Beltway in Montgomery County, you're not tapping the brakes. In Prince George's County, on the Beltway, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop. Heads up in D.C., Wisconsin Avenue. Both directions are shut down right now for police investigation between Calvert Street and Edmund Street. And on 95 in Virginia, southbound at Quantico, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked after 619. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Cold start to your weekend with a little bit of light rain and snow possible mid-morning to early afternoon. A coating in the grass, not out of the question, but no real big issues for the roadways. The only concern, higher elevations out west. Highs today only in the upper 30s. Tonight, cold, maybe some patchy fog in spots. Tomorrow, back into some sunshine, mid and upper 50s to near 60. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff.
31 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:34, the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update, and we're joined by Jennifer Harper. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Will he or won't he? This question has been bouncing around. Every time they think they have the answer, then somebody throws a wrench in the gearbox. So what is the latest on Joe Biden in 2024?
Yeah, that is the question that just keeps drawing endless attention. And the question is coming from pollsters and analysts and fans and enemies alike. And they all wonder the same thing. At age 80, does President Biden have the personal determination and energy, the mojo, so to speak, to run for reelection when the time comes? And I talked to somebody who is absolutely sure he's going to do it. And this is coming actually from a presidential historian, and that would be Craig Shirley. He has written multiple books on Ronald Reagan and lots more. He's got a very good perspective on all this. And he says he's going to run. He loves power. This is what Mr. Shirley says. He loves power. His family loves power and graft. He fought to get there, and it will take him being dragged out by his fingertips to leave. And Mr. Shirley adds that power is a very seductive thing. He says, name one president who ever walked away from power. Washington and the Founding Fathers, but they were the exception. This is why the 22nd Amendment was passed, to limit presidential power, lest we'd end up with another FDR. Again, this is coming from Craig Shirley, and he's referring, of course, to Franklin D. Roosevelt, who served as the 32nd president of the United States from 1933 until he passed away in 1945. For four terms, but Mr. Shirley also offered some pretty interesting historical information on that. He says, William Tecumseh Sherman is the only man I could think of who could have been president but refused. And, of course, I had to look all that kind of stuff up. And he is referring to the very distinguished and decorated Civil War general who attended West Point, fought for the Union and stayed on the job for many years afterwards. He said in February 1884, Sherman retired from the Army. He lived in St. Louis before moving to New York in 1886, where he devoted his time to theater, amateur painting, and speaking at dinners and banquets. He declined to run for the presidency, saying, I will not accept if nominated, and I will not serve if elected. So that's who didn't want to run. And, you know, you got to ask a question, too. What is the press saying, Rick? What do you think they say about Mr. Biden running again?
Well, there's a lot of speculation in the media. Man, the pundits are making $1 million a minute.
Yeah, they are indeed. And I took out, just for fun, I looked at a sampling of the headlines, which has appeared actually in the past 48 hours. And here's what Politico says. Biden may not run, and Democrats are quietly preparing. And the New York Post said Democrats are getting antsy as Biden holds off on his 2024 campaign launch. Are Trump and Biden too old to run again? That was what MSNBC asked. I think a lot of people are wondering that. They also expanded that question to include Donald Trump, who's already declared his intent. We already know that. And just if you're wondering, this waiting game on Biden has gone on for quite a few years. I found one of the first, Biden is planning to run again in 2024. That was coming from Politico. But the date was in 2021, so we're paying attention.
There are so many anniversaries that commemorate different presidential events, but there is one coming up with a former president that I think is truly unique.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I got this information from the Nixon Foundation that's associated with President Nixon. They are going to have quite an interesting event. They pointed out that about 50 years ago, the Vietnam War was ended by President Nixon, and hundreds of our prisoners of war came home, and the Paris Peace Accords were signed on January 27, 1973, and 591 prisoners of war were repatriated to America and poised to restart their life at home. So on May 24, 1973, then-President and Mrs. Nixon staged a huge dinner at the White House for the returning POWs. I did not know this. This is why I'm bringing it up this morning. He personally greeted each one of them, and First Lady Pat Nixon, Tricia Nixon Cox, and Julie Nixon were also there to talk to the wives, spouses, mothers, etc., for the returning heroes. And now the Nixon Foundation is going to recreate that very event. And this is what they have to say. On May 24th, of course, 1973, the Nixons hosted the largest dinner in White House history then and now. And on May 24th, 2023, exactly 50 years later, nearly 200 of those POWs will dine in the Nixon Library's White House East Room replica and recreate that dinner right down to the menu items and the centerpieces. This is according to the foundation, which they sent a statement to the Beltway. And they're going to have additional reunion events for them. There's a big new exhibition about the experiences of Vietnam POWs, a parade through the local streets of Yorba Linda, multiple recognition events, plus reflections and stories of those who had, who were there 5 decades ago. If you're curious about all this, it's pretty interesting. You can go to the NixonFoundation.org.
So we've spent so much attention talking about the problems at the southern border. Now we've got a problem at another border.
Yes, we do, and that would be the U.S. border with Canada. And the Daily Signal, that's a publication of the Heritage Foundation, has done a study here looking at how many folks who shouldn't be coming over the border are coming over the border rather than up there in Canada rather than down in the Texas-Mexico border. Here's what they say. So far in fiscal year 2023, which began on October 1, some 55,736 migrants have been encountered at the northern border, nearly as many as were encountered in 2020 and 2021 combined. They say if the trend continues, the northern border will experience a record number of encounters this year. In fiscal year 2022, the Customs Border Patrol reported 109,535 encounters at the northern border. So they are saying while the southern border garners most of the attention, both of America's borders are wide open because of the failed policies of the Biden administration. This is coming from Robert Law. He is director of the Center for Homeland Security and Immigration with the America First Policy Institute. This is what he told the Daily Signal. He said this administration is setting all the wrong records and exposing American communities to potential national security threats because of its refusal to defend the homeland. And certainly paying attention to the northern border is probably going to be in the news fairly soon.
And you have a headline of the day for us?
Yes, I do. I pay attention to headlines all week long. This is coming from National Review columnist Jim Garrity. He says, there's too much bull in Biden's China shop.
Ooh.
So there you go.
That's a good one. There's so many pollsters out there asking the members of the public what their political priorities are, but somebody else is actually asking too.
Yes, indeed. Someone we're paying attention to this week and every week, former President Donald Trump, and he still loves to ask voters questions about what they think. He did that when he was in office, and he's doing that when he's out of office and maybe going to be in office again. But anyway, he asked people in a questionnaire, what are your biggest priorities right now? And so here's what they said. This is verbatim from what the results were for this little kind of informal but interesting poll. So here's what people are concerned about: securing the border, stopping inflation, protecting your rights, ending pointless wars, putting America first, standing up to the woke agenda, fighting the deep state, ending big tech censorship, restoring integrity to our elections, backing the blue, standing up to China, and lowering taxes. So that's courtesy of former President Donald Trump. If you're wondering what people are concerned about, that's what it is.
Very interesting. Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Thank you, as always. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin.
Thanks a lot, Rick, and have a good weekend, everybody.
6:44, the Saturday Morning Update on WMAO. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next. We'll get the very latest on that Alex Murdoch trial down in Walterboro, South Carolina. But first, Al BD is in the WMAO Traffic Center.
On the Beltway in Virginia, looked at the cameras. Lanes are clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop. No delays in Fairfax County on 66 eastbound or westbound. On 95 in Virginia, southbound at Quantico, left lane is blocked for a crash after 619. No delays on the northbound side of 95. And in the district on 295, 395, and 695, don't have any reports of any slowdowns in your way. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Cold start to your weekend with a little bit of light rain and snow possible mid-morning to early afternoon. A coating in the grass, not out of the question, but no real big issues for the roadways. The only concern, higher elevations out west. Highs today only in the upper 30s. Tonight, cold, maybe some patchy fog in spots. Tomorrow, back into some sunshine, mid and upper 50s to near 60. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff.
31 degrees, 6:45 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Each week we like to check in with you on progress in the Trump Mar-a-Lago investigation. Much of it, I imagine, is behind the scenes, but anything on the public front this week?
No, really not. Unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff I'd love to talk about, but it's all behind the scenes. We're protected by secrecy rulings. So for now, stony silence.
Well, something that hasn't been behind the scenes or secret is the Alex Murdaugh trial in Walterboro, South Carolina. And Jim, the very latest, and first off, if you could just, for somebody that's not totally familiar, just in 25 words or less, what's it all about?
Yeah, well, this is Alex Murdaugh's murder trial for the slaying of his wife and son, Paul, in South Carolina. This is a very iconic family. You know, for those of us about our age, think Dallas. It's a well-known family in the legal community for many, many decades. And the extremely circumstantial but interesting murder trial of Alex Murdaugh carried on this week with Alex taking the stand, which is a little bit of a surprise. You know, this is a defendant who had an awful lot to explain, not just in terms of the murder itself, but his creation of a false alibi, his theft from his law firm, even the staged shooting that we talked about one Saturday morning, Rick, where he had a former client stage an ambush and shooting that grazed him in the head. The theory being that if he was killed, that his family would recover some of the losses that were accompanying his opioid addiction. So a lot of dirt on the table for a defendant to get on the stand and testify about on Thursday and Friday.
So he blamed his lying to the police on his opioid addiction. And then he tried, while on the stand, to put it out there that because the son that was murdered had earlier been involved in a fatal boat accident where he was basically blamed for killing a young woman. So Murdaugh brings this all up in the testimony, implying that someone else committed the murder in revenge. He's trying to create reasonable doubt with the jury. Is that something plausible to a jury?
Well, you know, the key is it only has to be plausible to one of the 12 to hang the jury. And I think that's really where this is kind of going. I just think that the circumstantial evidence here and his performance on the witness stand, from what I've seen and read, it was not so powerful to kind of undo the circumstances. It wasn't so powerful to create reasonable doubt in any sort of unanimous verdict. So, you know, my guess is that this is a guy who has always gotten by as being very charming and well-spoken, and he had very deep conversation with his attorneys about how it would play out if he testified. And partly because the creation of the false alibi was so strongly proven by the prosecutors, he made the decision to get on the witness stand. And you know, to me, it's a little bit of a reefer madness story. Remember the old movie where, you know, marijuana turned people into werewolves? Yeah, he's taking the opioid addiction, which is obviously a very serious thing and likely true in terms of his lifestyle, but he's blaming it for everything under the sun. He's blaming it for the thievery from his firm, his staged shooting that we talked about, and even his lying to the investigators. And frankly, that just doesn't hang together that cleanly to me, that because you have an opioid addiction, suddenly you're lying about the murder of your son and your wife. So it's an interesting exercise in credibility for this jury to go through. You know, they had the typical defense tactic on direct and on redirect exam where the questions were kind of, you know, point blank. Did you shoot your wife? Did you blow your son's head off? And you'd have a very tearful Alex Murdaugh say, of course not, I would never do that. On cross-examination, you generally don't ask these open-ended questions. You ask all leading questions, and most prosecutors and most defense attorneys, you know, really understand the difference there and how important it is. So I thought there was a couple of moments from the prosecution cross that probably didn't go that well yesterday. You know, when you ask the open-ended question, the argumentative question, are you a family annihilator? Well, you know, unlike Perry Mason episodes, most defendants on the witness stand are not going to say, you caught me, I'm a family annihilator. So, of course, Alex Murdaugh rejected that. There was a speech that was made during the cross-examination about, you know, Mr. Murdaugh, when the chips are down, you always pretend you're a victim and you lie and people come and support you. Well, of course he's going to reject that. I mean, these are the things of closing argument. And most experienced prosecutors know you have to pull up a little bit short of making the closing argument in your cross-examination. Save it for closing. Don't just expect that a defendant is going to help you make that argument. So I think that the cross-examination, which went over a long period of Thursday and Friday, was probably largely effective in just showing how many excuses this man tried to come up with to explain dishonesty, how many different times he was dishonest. But ultimately, it's not up to me or any of the commentator. It's up to the 12 people as to whether they really accept it as credible testimony.
You know, in a case like this, there are quirky little moments in the courtroom that stand out and sometimes make the news in the evening. And one stood out to you this week?
Yeah, and let me just tell you, so I don't sound like I'm too much of a grump on these things, I don't have any real problem with an occasional moment of humor, even in very serious trials. I mean, I've had those moments, and I don't think it necessarily played out poorly to make an appropriate kind of quip or joke or whatever during the long hours that you're in court on serious matters. The one I'm struggling with was when the prosecution had introduced a shotgun into evidence and was talking about the firing mechanism and showing the jury the gun, the defense attorney, who's also a well-known local politician, took the gun and pointed it at the prosecutors and made a little murmuring joke about, oh, it's tempting. Now everybody in the courtroom got a good laugh. So, again, I don't want to sound like I'm such a killjoy. And the fact is, most of the time, if you have a gun in the courtroom, you've shown it to the courtroom deputies or sheriffs. They've looked at it, made sure 100 times that there's nothing wrong with the gun, maybe even put plastic cuffs, you know, plastic handcuffs through it so you can't pull the trigger. They render it safe. That's part of their job, and it's part of your job as a lawyer to make sure that they've done that. But ultimately, it's just a fundamentally unsafe moment to point a gun and to do that in an open court. Remember in the Rittenhouse trial, a lot of people had a problem with the prosecutor pointing the gun towards the jury. I think the same holds true here. And I also think from a defense perspective, it's just the wrong case to joke around about killing people. It's not a particularly good look for the defense attorney. It looks more like the defense attorney is enjoying the limelight rather than vigorously defending Mr. Murdaugh. So, again, I might be the only person that criticizes this, and I usually have a decent sense of humor, but I think this is a bad moment for the system and particularly for that attorney.
We've seen so many stories about prosecutors in major urban areas and the George Soros funding and the soft-on-crime theme that we're hearing around the country. And we often ask, what can we do about it? Why isn't somebody doing something about it? Well, in Missouri, the state attorney general is taking action against the progressive St. Louis district attorney, and it was triggered by one more incident involving the suspect. So bring us up to date on what happened that triggered that action by the AG and what may come next.
Yeah, this is a really horrific story with obviously political repercussions that are going to be interesting to follow. It's the story of an avoidable tragedy in St. Louis, and the story really begins with a beautiful teenager named Janae Edmondson, who's a volleyball standout in Tennessee. She had verbally indicated just about 2 weeks ago that she was going to commit to the University of Tennessee, play in her home state, and play volleyball on a college level. And as a senior in high school, she went with her parents on a tournament visit to St. Louis. Her parents and her were walking around downtown St. Louis about 8:30 at night last Saturday when there was a vehicular crash where a car slammed into her, severing one leg and maiming the other immediately. The father, who had a military background, literally took off his belt. The mentality of this is incredible, the heroism and kind of the cool thinking, but took off his belt and another belt, tied tourniquets, almost undoubtedly saved her life. But she lost both legs. And the driver that caused this harm is a man named Daniel Riley, 21-year-old. Riley had come into the criminal justice system a few years ago at a young age, at 18, and he was accused, as they frame it in St. Louis, he was accused of stealing a gun at gunpoint. Well, that's called armed robbery. But he committed an armed robbery that was charged in 2020. The progressive prosecutor for St. Louis, Kimberly Gardner, her office decided to dismiss the case. And so Riley kind of ran loose for a long time, despite what seems to be a legitimate robbery charge. It was refiled in 2022, and that's why I say a legitimate charge. Somebody had to view it as having sufficient evidence to recharge it in 2022. No real explanation for why they dropped the ball for 2 years. Well, once the defendant was charged with the, again, refiling, he has continuously violated his conditions of release. I think one of the reports said he had violated his home detention electronic monitoring 51 times, and he was leaving his home over and over again. Gardner's office is accused of never trying to revoke his bond. She says they tried at one point in 2021, but the judge wouldn't do it. Again, I don't know if one out of 51 violations is particularly impressive. And it's turned into a very public battle between the state attorney general, who says Gardner has been creating these problems with their progressive policies for some time, and we've talked about this a bunch, Rick, that there's a brain drain, you know, that the actual career prosecutors, the people with experience, the people that know that community have left because they couldn't stand working for her with her very hardcore left-wing policies and often kind of race-based policies when it came to the prosecution of crime in St. Louis. So Gardner is kind of digging in, saying that she's being attacked by racists. She's even accused the judges as manipulating their results to hurt her politically. And again, this is a person who basically wrote in the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson into office in 2017. The attorney general says not only has she endangered the community, but her explanations for what she's done or not done on cases like Daniel Riley's changes by the minute. So we're in for a real pitched fight, a political battle of great interest in terms of yet another progressive prosecutor with a horrific story attached to them. But, you know, for Janae Edmondson and her family, unfortunately, the damage is done. And it's a tragic tale no matter how the politics shake out.
The Alec Baldwin Rust shooting case has been in the news recently. And give us the latest on that, Jim. There was a change in the charges.
Yeah, well, the very latest was an arraignment, which is a very standard procedure, essentially where the defendant's advised of the charges and pleads guilty or not guilty. This was actually mailed in. Baldwin himself didn't have to come. His attorneys took care of it for him. But he was arraigned on only the involuntary manslaughter. And what's interesting is what had happened over the course of the last week or two was Baldwin's attorneys filed a motion accusing the prosecutor of unconstitutionally using these enhancement charges. We talked about how the enhancement, the use of a firearm in an involuntary manslaughter, could lead to 5 years in prison rather than 18 months. And so that was a weighty part of the charging document. What's interesting is kind of two levels here. One is that Baldwin's lawyers did their homework, frankly. They realized that this particular enhancement didn't come into being until May of 2022 after the shooting on the set of the movie Rust. So it's an ex post facto provision. The Constitution says you've got to be charged with crimes that were criminal when you committed the crime. And so they actually got a withdrawal of the more serious enhancement by the DA's office. What was interesting on the second level is not just this kind of tactical and important win for Baldwin's lawyers, but the prosecutors are really coming off, in my mind, as kind of amateur hour. You know, the DA's done a lot of media announcements. When the motion was filed, they put out a statement saying the fancy lawyers were trying to distract people from the horrific negligence of Alec Baldwin, and even said another day, another motion. Well, that's pretty glib stuff if you're going to turn around, read the motion, and be convinced, which apparently they were. So they pulled the plug without a hearing before the judge, you know, after trashing the kind of out-of-town fancy lawyers for filing it in the first place. So it's a pretty major win for Baldwin that now whatever happens, if he's incarcerated, the maximum is 18 months instead of 5 years. And I look back to what we talked about, I think, the very first time we discussed this case, which was the wrongful death case filed by the family of the victim. That's settled civilly with the non-disclosure terms, so we don't know everything about it. But the case itself, the complaint itself, laid out a withering case of gross negligence. And I think if even that's 75% accurate, the prosecution still has a very good case for involuntary manslaughter. But the media stuff they're doing is going to backfire. It's making them look silly. It's not helping them with the court of public opinion, which can sometimes translate into the jury pool that you get. And so we'll keep an eye on this case. The next thing that comes after this arraignment this week is a preliminary hearing, which hasn't been scheduled yet, but that's where you have to put on actual evidence, and a judge will decide whether there's enough probable cause for Baldwin to stand trial for involuntary manslaughter. So we'll get a real good look at the strength of the government's evidence when they have that preliminary hearing, which might still be, you know, April or May by the time they get it set.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. As always, Jim, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. Have a good weekend, Rick.
And you too. You can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. 7 o'clock news next with Heather Curtis, then back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL-FM.